Krishna, let's start on the government level, particularly, for instance, today the Dutch government has, or the Dutch courts have just struck down a data retention bill. Is that likely to be a one-off, or can you see that moving around the world to other governments?
You know, I don't know. I hope it's going to move around the world. Mandatory retention laws are, I think, are dangerous. They put us all at risk. So the less we have them, the better. I think the ruling was great, and I'd like to see more of it.
We are in the process in this country of bringing in data retention laws, and they are pretty wide-ranging. Could you explain, from your point of view, as somebody who's studied it a lot, what is wrong with retaining people's data?
Well, the first thing we learn is that retaining data has risks. In the United States, we've had some pretty big data breaches. Target Corporation, Home Depot, another retailer, Anthem Health, a medical insurance company. Hackers broke into these companies and stole tens of millions of records of individuals. Now, if there were data retention laws, there'd be even more data, even more personal data. So as soon as companies have your data, you are at risk. And having the government force you to be more at risk seems kind of backwards. And now this data is a risk by the companies and governments that have it. This is data that's used to judge us. This is data that's used for sort of all sorts of reasons that might not be a good idea. Right now, businesses decide whether they should keep our data or not based on business reasons. For governments to say, business be damned, you're going to do this because we want you to, seems real backwards.
And how much does a government know about us from the metadata that it gathers about us?
It really depends on the government. A lot of governments are collecting surveillance data, and that's what metadata is. It's surveillance data. It's where you went, it's who you spoke to, it's what you did. And different governments collect different amounts. Right? In the United States, we collect telephone metadata, so the government knows who your friends are, who your associates are, who your intimates are. I mean, the people you call late at night, you're going to be your intimate friends. The Chinese government collects a lot more data. Australian government, we believe, collects quite a lot of metadata as well. Thing about metadata is it really reveals who you are, much more than your conversations. So governments know a lot. The question is what they do about it, and that depends on the government, of course.
And big stores and commercial companies also know a great deal about you.
Well, this again depends on which country you're in. In the United States, there's a lot of corporate surveillance going on the internet and off. And data brokers is a huge industry in the United States, buying and selling our personal data, data of the things we purchase, data of the places we go, the things we look for online. There are hundreds of companies that track us on the internet. And this data also provides a surprisingly intimate picture of who we are. This is data that's used for psychological manipulation, persuasion, convincing you you want to buy something you might not want to buy before you are convinced. Governments use this data. So yes, there's quite a lot of intimate information about us on the internet. I mean, think about it. Google knows exactly what kind of porn every listener likes.
And there was a case not too long ago in a New York Times article I read about this of a woman who Walmart discovered she was pregnant just by looking at her buying habits before she'd started buying any baby clothes or anything like that. So that this goes pretty deep. I mean, they can work things out way before you might think they can.
It was Target Corporation, and they identified certain buying habits with pregnant women and were marketed them because of that. But there are lots of examples of this. Facebook knows you're gay even if you haven't come out. You can use Twitter to figure out where people live, even if they don't announce it. A lot of information that we think is private is known by these companies. In the United States, we have a ride-sharing service called Uber. It's like an internet taxi.
That's come to Australia, too.
And so Uber knows where you get dropped off and where you get picked up. It knows the route. So in the United States, the president of Uber posted a funny post on his website where he looked at people who use Uber to have sex. So he found rides. People went somewhere late at night and came back the next morning. And he published fun statistics of which cities were the best for this and which neighborhoods. And he published aggregate stats. So he didn't announce who's using Uber to go have sex, but he has the individual stats. He could have, and there's nothing in U.S. law preventing him from doing it. It's just really creepy.
He could have published the individual stats.
But of course, he has the data. I mean, you can go to your Uber page and see your receipt history, which includes maps of where you ran the trips and what time of day and what date. So yes, so he knows if you take Uber to go somewhere late at night and you come back the next morning, he knows you're sleeping there.
Sure, but I was really struck by what you said about there being no law to stop him publishing it.
In the United States, we have actually very, very poor privacy laws. We have privacy laws in certain circumstances for financial data, for certain types of data, for videotape rental data, but there's no general data privacy law. In Europe, it's different. I mean, there are more stringent data privacy laws. I don't know about the laws in Australia.
But what about the argument that governments regularly use, which is that if you've got nothing to hide, then you've got nothing to fear, and that they need these things to trace terrorism and international crime?
Well, it's a dumb argument. I mean, you know, everybody that makes that argument doesn't announce everything they do, and they don't put themselves under surveillance. They don't give a detailed account of where they've been every minute, how much money they have, what they buy. Privacy is not about something to hide. Privacy is about personal individuality, autonomy, freedom. Privacy is about how you present your face to the world. All those politicians know that. They carefully craft the image they present, and they do that because privacy is important. And we all do it, right? Privacy is about freedom and liberty and being able to be in charge of your own data and your own self. You know, as to the "we needed to catch terrorists and criminals" argument, you know, I haven't seen, at least in the United States, a giant crime wave of crimes unsolvable because of the police being unable to eavesdrop on data. You know, there might be some enormous crime wave in Australia that they desperately need data retention, or all of these murderers are going scot-free. I don't know the data. I kind of doubt it. But police have been solving crimes for a whole lot of years. And at least in the United States, whenever you ask them, can you give some evidence of that idea that you can't solve crimes or stop terrorism without it? They never can produce real examples. They're just going to make up hypothetical stories. So when a politician says that, press them on it. Get the data.
20 years ago, when I was a London correspondent, the British started putting CCTV cameras all through their streets. And there was a lot of fear that people would be followed, that you'd be able to track people around the country in exactly the way that we're talking about now. Now, people have forgotten about that. 20 years on, will people have forgotten about this? Will this kind of surveillance society have just become normal?
You know, sort of two ways this could go. This could go normal because you're right, people do tend to adapt to what's happening. Or people can finally say that, you know, enough is enough. Privacy is really important. Without it, we become conformists. We lose our individuality. We don't try new things. Society stagnates. And privacy is one of those rights you really don't notice until it's gone. So there's going to come to a point where people say, this is just unacceptable. We cannot live this way. We cannot be under constant surveillance by governments and by corporations, by marketers. The question of when, I don't know. Yes, there are cameras everywhere in the UK, and right now they're being linked. Right now they're being used to track everybody. A lot of it's happening behind the scenes. So it takes people to understand what's happening to really object.
So short of forming a political party whose main platform is privacy, how do you use your vote? What do you do at the ballot box to express your fears about this?
I think you have to make this a political issue. People need to talk about it. I'm hoping it's an issue in the next U.S. election, which is coming up real soon. And the more people talk about it, the more politicians talk about it, the more it becomes an election issue. If nobody talks about it, politicians don't care, and they'll do what companies want, they'll do what law enforcement and national intelligence wants, and this won't be an issue. But there's been a change, at least in the United States, post-Edward Snowden. More people are talking about it, and more people care. Whether it becomes an issue now or it's going to be in 5 years, I don't know. But
I mean, I do think this has to be made into a political issue. You know, it's not forming a political party. We don't really do that in the United States. But we sort of make it an issue that the existing political parties have to address.
So far, we've been talking a lot about the relations between the citizen and the state. But what can the individual citizen do? I mean, for instance, are you and I being listened to or potentially being listened to when we speak on this Skype line?
We potentially are. So we know that the NSA has the ability to listen into Skype calls. We don't know how extensive it is. Our call is going outside the United States, so the normal U.S. law that protects me is much, much more relaxed. I don't know about Australian law. Certainly, Microsoft, who owns Skype, isn't listening on our call, but they know we've made this call, so they know that you and I are connected, you know, which in some ways is more important than what we're saying. You know, other governments, you know, might the Chinese be listening? They certainly can. Our connection might go through a cable that they have access to and are eavesdropping on. And on the internet, we actually don't know. So all the surveillance is surreptitious. It's not overt. So we don't see it.
And if you and I were both using, were each using a virtual private network, a VPN or something called Tor, would we be secure then?
Well, now, again, it depends. We'd be more secure, certainly. So we have a lot of NSA documents that talk about how they break virtual private networks. So some of them are vulnerable. Some of them aren't. They will steal keys. They will attack implementations. So now it depends on whether we are sufficiently an important target that the NSA or China or Russia or the Australian government will take the time to break our traffic. They might or they might not. Right, we know Tor works, but there are still ways to break it individually. Now, what those tools do is it forces these agencies to target their attacks. And one hopes when they target, they will target on the legitimate bad guys and leave people like you and I alone.
And if you want to protect yourself from being monitored by big corporations or the government, what do you do with your mobile phone or your credit card? How do you behave in that way to protect your own privacy?
The sad answer is you throw them both away. This is the unfortunate answer, that your cell phone is a tracking device. It has to be. In order for that phone to ring where you are, it has to know where you are, right? It knows who you're calling, who's calling you. It has to receive your text messages and your browsing. And that device is a surveillance device. There's no way to not make it that.
So even going into the settings
credit card has to,
and switching on all the privacy functions is not going to protect you.
If that phone if your cell phone rings, it knows where you are. Otherwise, it can't work.
So right? For
your credit card to work, it has to know that you are purchasing this thing. Most of our data is in the hand of third parties. This is why this is important. That the things we can do are around the edges, but our emails with Google, our finances are with Visa, our telephone calls and text messages are with our phone company, and these third parties have our data, and there's nothing we can do about it except not give them the data. Now, this is actually a very lousy device. Throw away your cell phone and credit card, don't have an email address, don't go on Facebook. You can't tell people to do that. Those are the tools of modern life. You can't be a fully functioning member of society without them.
Especially as we move towards the cashless economy.
That's right. It's very hard to use cash, but you could using cash, right? Not using the telephone or, you know, not using email. But this is increasingly difficult. That's why this is a political problem. It's not something technology can fix.
And for instance, journalists, and this is a hot issue here, journalists who want to talk to whistleblowers or whistleblowers who want to talk to journalists, you would say put the phone in the fridge, as it were, or in a lead box or whatever, and leave it behind when you go to have your meeting.
The journalists I know who talk to whistleblowers and informants do those things. Meet them in person. Don't talk on the phone. Don't talk via email. Even with all the security, it is much safer to be face-to-face, voice-to-voice.
And even then, you never know where the CCTV cameras are.
You never know, but that gets a little much, right? I mean, it's unlikely
you're going to be followed. I mean, yes, after the fact, you might be noticed, and maybe you want to go somewhere where there aren't cameras. But the collection that's automatic via the electronic devices we use, via the computers we use, is much more pervasive.
So overall, then, do you think that, are you an optimist about this? Do you think that change can be effected? Or, as I say, will it go the way of the CCTV cameras where they just become ubiquitous and everybody forgets about it?
I'm long-term optimistic, even though I'm a short-term pessimistic. I think change will happen. I don't think this is the end of the great democratic experiment. We're going to live in a surveillance state for the rest of our lives. I mean, the rest of our culture. But it might take a generation or two to fix. Right? This is something that is so big. I think people who are born into this world need to fix it, and it might be that we can't. Hope I'm wrong, but I think this might be a problem for 10, 20, 30 years down the road.
Bruce Schneier, thank you very much for your time.
Hey, thank you.